The Tom Woods Show, episode 823.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
All you men out there, if you're looking for a smooth, close shave, you need Harry's Razors. They're going to let you try out their shave set for free. Just pay shipping at harrys.com. And when you use code Woods, you get a post-shave balm for free as well. Check it out at harrys.com using code Woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We are celebrating a great milestone in the life and work of Walter Block, our friend, the great libertarian scholar. He has just reached a milestone that he's been working toward for many years, and that is he has just had his 500th scholarly article published. This number, by way of comparison, is far beyond that of pretty much anybody you've ever heard of when it comes to the academic literature. Nobody writes 500 scholarly articles, but Walter Block has done it, and I want to talk to him about it. I want to talk to him about the kinds of things he's written about, the kinds of areas he's contributed to, what kind of advice he has for people who are looking to get published. Lots to talk about here. Walter, of course, holds the Harold E. Worth Eminent Scholar Chair in Economics at Loyola University in New Orleans. He's the author of probably around 24 books or so, and, well, as you now know, 500 scholarly articles, as well as many, 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 many articles in various popular publications. He speaks on a wide variety of topics in a wide variety of venues. He's just been there, done that, with almost everything that you can think of relating to libertarianism, and I'm really glad to welcome him back to the show. Walter, welcome back.
My pleasure to be with you, as always.
Well, this is a momentous occasion, and I told you on a previous episode, however many ago it was, that when you hit 500 published articles in the academic literature, I would have you back, and you remembered, you wrote to me and said, I'm on the verge, let's schedule it, and now it has happened. Here we are in January 2017. You hit 500 scholarly articles. Let's clarify for people why that's different from writing 500 newspaper articles. What's the difference? Some people who aren't in academia won't even know.
Well, there are several differences. One, a newspaper op-ed is usually 600 or 800 words. A refereed journal article or an article in a law review, the scholarly literature is 800 words would not be accepted. It's usually at least 3,000 words, and it can be up to, 30,000 words. So it's much, much bigger. Secondly, you have to go through a refereeing process at an academic journal. And with an op-ed, especially if it's electronic, you don't. You just sort of spew it off, spew it out, whatever. So it's much more restricted to get an article in a law review or in a refereed journal in the scholarly literature.
Tell me when and what the subject was of your very first published scholarly article.
Well, hang on one second. I have to go look it up. I don't remember.
You don't offhand remember my proudest moment? It was my first ever published article?
Sorry.
That's funny.
Pathetic. It was a long time ago.
Jeez, I remember not. I don't know what my first scholarly article was, but I know my very first published piece was in Chronicles magazine in 94.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
And it was about the Harvard graduation. I was letting my mouth off to somebody at the Mises Institute about how ridiculous it was and the terrible speakers. And one of them said, why don't you write it up as an article? And the thought never occurred to me. And that began my writing career right there. All right. That was a little bit of an interlude while you're looking up your first article. Have you gotten there?
Yes. My first article was a book review of Thomas V. Torres and Bennett Harrison, The Economic Development of Harlem, and it was put in the journal Growth and Change, and this was in 1971.
1971. You were a pup.
A pup, a baby.
I'm not trying to make you feel old, but I wasn't even born yet when you wrote that first article.
Well, you have to have more respect for me, Tom. I'm 75 years old now.
That is unbelievable. All right. Well, what do you remember what the gist of that article was? Oh, no. Am I asking too much here?
That's okay. I was probably criticizing them. I don't remember it very clearly, but the economic development of Harlem, their view, I think, was more government money to Harlem. my view was more free enterprise.
All right. So you've been pretty consistent over the years. So that's these sorts of things I want to ask you about. I will at some point get into advice you might have for people looking to get published, all that. But I'm interested in your record of publication, which is amazing. You hit 500 articles. Surely you went out for a nice dinner. You did something, right?
Not really. I don't know. It's just a number.
No, it is not. It is. If it were just a number, you would not be on the show right now. I'm telling you that right now.
It's true. It's a round number and it's a big number, but it's just a number. For example, I now have about 20 articles that are forthcoming. Namely, they've been accepted for publication. So I'm really at 520 if you want to count it that way. And I was at 500 if you include accepted articles that are forthcoming in a month or two or three. So 500, I didn't go out and have a special meal or have a special celebration. But I am delighted to share this good news with you. And hopefully my school, Loyola University, will in some way, get publicity out of this. Although the upper administration here isn't really that enamored of my publications because they're social justice warriors, and most of my stuff is not really fully compatible with social justice warrioring, if I could make that word up.
But we know how tolerant these folks are of other views. They're always lecturing us on being open-minded. So I'm sure they'll have a campus-wide event commemorating your 500 articles. I can't wait. Maybe I'll fly over there and attend.
Well,
if that happened, by the way, I'm now pledging I would be there.
They do favor diversity of race and sex and gender and sexual orientation. And also I'm trying to get them to do it for people who are bald, but they haven't made that a protected group yet. But there's one thing that they're really not in favor of diversity on, and that's ideology or intellectual diversity. So, we want a black feminist, a gay Marxist, and I don't know, whatever. But to have a free enterprise or an Austro-libertarian is not as fully appreciated as it might be.
No doubt. So you've published 500. Now, that's not to, as I say, if you're talking about newspaper articles and stuff, you've published many, many, many articles of that sort.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We're just focusing on the academic literature here.
Yeah.
As you look back over a career of, let's see, so 29 plus 17, well, let's just say that's many years of publishing. Are there any topics in those articles where your views have evolved or changed in any way? Or you look back and say, if I had that article to do over again, I wouldn't make this point, I'd make that one, that sort of thing.
Not really. There is I also have about 23 books published, and there was one book called Defending the Undefendable, where I regretted something that I said, and in a subsequent volume of it or a subsequent edition of it, I got rid of that. But I think that's the only thing I really regretted. I don't think I've changed my views on anarchism or Austrianism or libertarianism or anything like that. There is one thing I regret, and that is you're not supposed to publish any of these in two places. And one of my articles was published in two places. I only counted as one article, and that was a mistake of the editor. I didn't. What happened was I thought Journal A had rejected the paper, and I sent it to Journal B, and Journal B published it. But then Journal A also published it, so I regret that.
Wasn't there a time when you wrote a review of a book and submitted it somewhere, and then you'd forgotten you'd reviewed it, so you reviewed it again? Wasn't there something like that? Am I misremembering that?
Yes, I did that. I'm an absent-minded professor, and I did review the same book twice, but I did it differently or in different words. You know, I had forgotten it, and that I counted twice because it was two different publications. It was a review of the same book. Now, obviously, I wouldn't have too much of a difference. It was, you know, probably 6 months before that I reviewed the book, and then I reviewed it 6 months later. But there was no verbatim repeat kind of a thing. So it's not that I copied it and then sent it to another journal. It's rather I reviewed the book again. I'd forgotten that I'd reviewed it.
Do you remember what book it was?
No.
Okay. It's apparently this book is not easy to remember. All right. Let's talk about some of the back and forths you've had, because a lot of times when you get into a dispute with somebody, you say, look, buddy, let's take it to the journals. We'll hash this out in the journals. And you are known for being relentless. You just won't let up.
Yes.
If the guy hasn't converted to anarcho-capitalism, you're going to keep that argument going and going and going and going. Can you tell me maybe one of your favorite exchanges that you've had?
Well, before I do that, I'm a professor. I'm never allowed to answer questions directly. I have to go circuitously. So let me take a little side road here. There's this guy, Sherwin Rosen, who wrote an article. He recently passed away. He was a professor at the University of Chicago. And he said, how do we know that Austrian economics is wrong and that neoclassical economics is right? And his answer was, well, there are more neoclassical economists than there are Austrian economists. QED, ergo, you know. That proves that Austrianism is wrong. Now, obviously, this is crazy because you can't say that neoclassical is right and Austrianism is wrong just because there are more of them than us. You know, that's crazy. I mean, at one time, phlogiston theory, most physicists agreed with it, and now they don't. So you can't do that. So me and my two co-authors, what we said, we wrote an article attacking him, and he said, look, there is no objective way to tell which school of thought is more correct. You have to get down and dirty into the trenches and say, well, how about on this point? How about on Austrian business cycle theory? How about on antitrust? You know, what are the arguments? You can't do that. However, let's try a reductio. We have another objective criteria for who is right. And this gets me back to the question you asked. And that is, who publishes last? In other words, Tom, if you and I are having a debate and you publish 1, 3, 5, and 7, and I publish 2, 4, 6, and 8, I win because I published last. And then if you publish a ninth article in this debate, then you win. Whoever writes last wins. Now, this is obviously silly because, you know, I might attack an article of yours and you don't reply because you don't think that it's worthy of your time because you think I'm an idiot. So I got the last word, but so that's crazy. Another reason might be what you and I are having an argument and all of a sudden I die. I'm older than you and I pass away. And then you write one more article. Well, then you win. So the whole thing is crazy. However, it's just as sensible as counting noses to see who is right. So anyway, me and my two co-authors, here I can probably look up my two co-authors if you want. One of them was Wesley. Let me look up Wesley.
Chris Wesley?
Yeah, Wesley was one.
All right. Well, for everybody listening, he's now at Florida Gulf Coast University.
Oh, is he? Yeah. The other is Alex Padilla. This is my 290th article.
Okay.
It was published in the Procesos de Mercado Revista Europea de Economia Politica. This is the journal of Huerta de Soto in Spain. And what we said is he who publishes last is right. And what we did is we got every debate between an Austrian and a neoclassical, and we had all about 250 of them. And we said, well, who published last in each case? And guess what? We published last in about 200 and they in about 100. I forget the exact numbers. So therefore, we declared that Austrianism is correct.
All right. But people could stop answering us because they feel defeated or because they're totally exasperated, right?
Right. Or because they die. So the whole thing is silly.
We just hound them throughout life.
Right. But it's no more silly than what Sherwin Rosen said. So now let's get back to the question you asked. Which debate or series am I stands out and most?
By the way, I think I know what it is.
Yes.
Is it the Harold Demsetz one?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Okay. So go ahead and tell people about it.
Well, Harold Demsetz and I got into it. And what happened is I wrote an article attacking Coase for being a commie.
All right. Now, hold on a minute. Most people aren't going to know who Coase is.
Oh, Ronald Coase is a Nobel Prize winning economist. And not only is he a Nobel Prize winning economist, of whom there are maybe 100 now over the last 60, 70 years, because sometimes they award it to two or three people. But he is one that is distinguished in many ways. One way is he was not awarded it with someone else. Like Hayek was awarded it with someone else. So he only had half a share, but Coase had the whole share. And another thing is Coase didn't really write that many articles. Many Nobel Prize winning people, they may not write 500 referee journals, but they'll write 100 or 200. Coase only wrote maybe 10 or 12, so very small amount. But In academia, what you get brownie points for is not only writing journal articles and in prestigious journals. Another point I have to mention, virtually none of mine are in any prestigious journals, at least prestigious as known by the mainstream. I've got maybe one or two, but not very much. Most of my stuff is in Austrian journals and libertarian journals, and these are considered, I guess, cultish. So anyway, getting back to Coase, not only do you get brownie points in academia for getting journal articles published, and by the way, journal articles are much more important than books. In some cases, if you go up for tenure and you have three or four books in economics, they either don't count it or they count it against you. What they want is referee journals in academic journals, refereed articles there. So in terms of, so what is even more important than getting published in a referee journal? Citations. If your article gets published in a nice journal or even in a poor journal and it gets cited heavily by everybody and his uncle, well, now you get brownie points. Well, Coase's article on social costs, and he, as I say, he's written maybe a dozen articles. I'm not sure the exact number. That is the most heavily cited journal article of all journal articles. So Coase is very, very famous for that. And what I did is following Murray Rothbard in this and in many, many other things. I really have to call out Murray Rothbard as my mentor, my guru, my friend. Murray might have written something criticizing Coase. He once wrote something criticizing blackmail laws and man economy in state. And he spent, two sentences on that. And I must have written, 30 articles on blackmail, and I have a book now of these 30 articles. Well, a similar thing happened with Coase. Murray might have, I think, mentioned Coase as being an idiot, and in a sort of a throwaway place, or maybe one article. In one article, I remember his thing on air pollution. He did mention Coase there. And what I did is I must have, written maybe 15, 20 articles saying what a moron and a commie Coase was. And Harold Demsetz, who hasn't won a Nobel Prize, but he's perhaps my most famous, most prestigious in mainstream view opponent. And I think he's a Nobelabile. Nobelabile means, when they're trying to pick a new pope, there might be six or eight cardinals who are papabile, namely capable of being pope, and these are the favorites. Well, every year before the Nobel Prize in economics is awarded, they mention 5 or 10 or 15 people, and Harold Demsetz is usually mentioned. So in any case, he wrote a blistering attack on one of my articles, and it was in a book that Mario Rizzo edited. And I wrote a reply saying, you're wrong, Harold. Coase is really no good, and your defense of him doesn't hold water. And he wrote an article saying, Block is an idiot. I'm just giving the gist here. And then I wrote one, and he wrote one, and I wrote the last one. Ha ha! So I won that debate.
But how long did that go? That went a long time, didn't it?
Yes, it went a very, very long time, and he bitterly complained. It was over many, many years. The reason was
I spoke over you. It was over how many years?
Oh, maybe 20 years. I could get the exact.
Well, that's a long time.
Yeah,
some people listening to the show now are going to be younger than that.
Yes, that's true. Maybe 15 years. I forget how long it was. But the reason it was is I was working for the Fraser Institute, and I worked for the Fraser Institute for 12 years. And I feared to write an article criticizing him because I would have been fired. As it happened, I was fired by them for being too free enterprise, but that's a whole other story. So after I was fired from the Fraser Institute, I wrote the third in this series of five. And then he wrote a reply, and then I wrote another reply. So that's why that debate took so long, because I was afraid of getting fired for criticizing him, because the Fraser Institute people, Mike Walker, revered neoclassical economics and sort of only tolerated my Austrianism.
More to come as we celebrate this great milestone with Walter Block after we hear the story of Bad Luck Ichabod. Folks, it's time for the story of Bad Luck Ichabod. We haven't heard from Bad Luck Ichabod in quite some time, but I'll tell you something. What a lousy shave Bad Luck Ichabod always got when he shaved with a blade. No matter what he did, his face wound up a bloody mess, and he couldn't understand how everybody else was getting this smooth, comfortable, close shave, and he looks like he's just been part of an axe murder movie. Well, folks, just like the walrus was Paul, I was Bad Luck Ichabod. That's right, I'm revealing the true identity of Bad Luck Ichabod. I was Bad Luck Ichabod. I could not shave with a blade. I just thought it was something wrong with me, so I've just been shaving with electric. But then I tried Harry's, and it is so smooth and comfortable. I look great. I feel great. I feel like I know what I'm doing now. So I want to recommend it to you. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set for free. You heard that right. Just cover shipping when you sign up. Plus, as a special offer for fans of the show, go to harrys.com right now and enter code WOODS at checkout to get a post-shave balm also free. That's harrys.com, code WOODS. Now, looking back on all these articles, what are you, I don't necessarily mean the one particular article, but just in general, what are you proudest of? What are the two or three things that you look back and say, I did that. That's a contribution. Or even if it wasn't particularly a contribution, I just did a good job on this subject.
Well, there are two or three things that if I look back on my whole career, and not just journal articles, but speeches and op-eds and all sorts of other things, that I think I've made some sort of contribution, as opposed to, you know, writing about, say, the minimum wage or rent control or free trade or stuff like that, which I have written on. But I don't really think that I've made a unique contribution there. Let me see if I can think of two or three things where I think I have made a contribution. One of them is on abortion. I have, 30 articles on that. I mean, when you have 500 articles, you have 30 articles on pretty much anything. Well, not everything, but many things. And I think I've made a contribution on evictionism. See, the problem there is that you have two very, very eminent libertarians who take the exact opposite view. Murray Rothbard is pro-choice. Ron Paul is pro-life. And you can't get two more highly credentialed libertarians than those two, I don't think. Maybe, I don't know, you could stick someone else in there. But I think those two are sort of head and shoulders above any other libertarian theorist. And they take opposite points of view on that. And my work on that is called evictionism, which is a compromise between pro-life and pro-choice. And I've written, 25, 30 articles on that. I'm going to come out with a book on that. So that's one area where I think I've made a contribution. Another area where I've made a contribution, again, is where libertarians are very divided, as is the general public, and that's immigration. And here you have Murray Rothbard, who changed his mind. When Murray Rothbard first wrote about immigration, he was an open borders guy. Then, subsequently, 10 years later or whatever, he and Hans Hoppe, who is another exquisitely credentialed libertarian, Hans Hoppe is one of the most brilliant libertarians ever to walk the planet. And Murray and Hans are against open borders. And then you have a whole bunch of people who are in favor of open borders, libertarians with, again, good libertarian credentials. And I, again, have written five or six or eight articles on this. And I try to, not a compromise, but I try to have our cake and eat it. You see, the argument that I make is, suppose a Martian or a Chinese guy or an African guy or just somebody from not the United States starts homesteading in the middle of Alaska or in the middle of Wyoming in the Rocky Mountains. And there's on virgin territory. Now, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management of the United States government, claims all this land, but they never homesteaded squat. So they don't really own it from a libertarian point of view. So from a libertarian point of view, this is virgin territory. So our Martian or African or Asian or whoever it is, South American, comes and starts homesteading. Well, did he violate the non-aggression principle? No. So therefore, if you restrict him from doing that, you're violating the non-aggression principle. And I don't like any violation of the non-aggression principle. So we have to have open borders. On the other hand, what about if a billion Martians or, Chinese, Africans, whoever it is, come? Won't they ruin our culture? Won't they commit crimes? Won't they, we have the rape-fugee problem in Germany and Sweden where these people come from Syria and they have a different view about women. If women are walking alone on the street, they're fair game, or certainly if they're wearing a miniskirt. And, Western civilization has a very different view on that. and they are rape fugees. They are raping women and molesting them and engaging in all sorts of crime, and we don't really want that. So what's the solution? The solution is, wait for it, we should have a drum roll, privatize every square inch of property. And if you privatize every square inch of property, then Hans and Murray are right, then an immigrant is a trespasser. So in that way, we can have our cake and eat it. We can keep the riffraff out and not violate the non-aggression principle. Another point is, a lot of people think that babies come from sexual intercourse. This is wrong. Babies come from the stork. The stork brings babies. And if it's a blue blanket, it's a boy baby. And if it's a pink blanket, it's a girl baby. Now, where do the storks get the baby from? Well, the country Storkovia. That's where all babies come, from Storkovia. So they're immigrants. So if you want to have regulated borders, then we have to have regulated birth. Tom, you have five lovely little girls. Did you get permission from the government to have those babies that you imported from Storkovia? No, you're a rotten kid, you and your wife. So here's a reductio ad absurdum of the closed or non-open borders position. Namely, you have to have restrictions on having babies like they had in China, which is slightly non-libertarian. So that's my contribution on borders. Let me just mention one thing about COAST, because I think that that's one of my third. Tom, we only go for a half hour.
You talking about your articles, we could just go forever, so don't worry about that.
Okay, I want to mention. So I one contribution that I made, I think, was in this business of immigration. Another one was with COAST and DemSets. And let me just talk a little bit about that, and then let me give you my view on abortion, because I think abortion is another contribution that I've made, an important contribution. So first, COAST. COAST has this view. We have, a zero transactions cost world. And in a zero transactions cost world, it doesn't matter what the judge says. Tom, you and I are now having a dispute as to this pair of shoes. And you say you own it, and I say I own it. And what COAST says, that in a zero transaction cost world, it doesn't matter what the judge says, the same person will get the shoes. So if you value the shoes at 100 and I value the shoes at 10, and the judge says you can get it, I won't be able to bribe you out of it, because I only value it at 10, you value it at 100, so you keep the shoes. On the other hand, if the judge awards me the shoes, I'll keep it. You'll keep it again, because you'll be able to bribe me out of it. You'll say, block, how about $50? And I'll say, sure, because then I'll make a $40 profit, because I value the shoes at 10 and you value it at 100. So you offer me 50 and I make 40 and you make 50, because that's the difference between 50 and 100. Now, I criticize that on technical grounds, namely, suppose you didn't have the money to bribe me out of it. You just valued those shoes at 100, but you don't have any money to bribe. So COAST even fails there. But that's a minor difficulty. The major difficulty with COAST that Murray pointed out and that I elaborated on was, now let's get back to the real world where there are high transactions costs. Think of, I want to build an airport and I have to bribe all the surrounding people to accept my noise pollution. And there are thousands or tens of thousands of people that are affected by airport. What COAST says is, what should the judge do? Who should the judge award the noise pollution rights? Or in the case where you and I, Tom, are fighting over this pair of shoes that you value at 100 and I value at 10, what COAST says is, give it to you, because you value it at 10, at 100, I'm sorry, and you value And if we give the shoes to you, the GDP will go up by 90 compared with me, because if the judge awards the shoes to me, I'll only value it at 10, so the GDP will be 10, whereas if the judge awards it to you, the GDP will be 100, namely 90 more, and the whole purpose of law is to maximize the GDP. That's a summary of the COAST DemSets position, and not just COAST and DemSets, but this is the neoclassical view. Well, what's wrong with that? Notice what's wrong with that is, it's very different than the libertarian view. The libertarian view of who owns this pair of shoes, you or I, Tom, is who bought it? Namely, we look in the past. Do I have a bill of sale for it? Can I prove by a picture that my grandmother gave me the shoes? And if so, I own it, even though I don't value it as much as you own it. Whereas the Coasean view, look to the future. You know, you're going to, I don't know, write wonderful poetry with these shoes or, you know, do great things. And all I'll do with these shoes is get drunk. So therefore, Coase would award you the shoes, even though I bought it and I made them, which is sort of, you know, horrible. Coase is worse than the commies. At least the commies had a theory of property rights, namely the bourgeois don't own it and the proletarian do. Coase's theory is really not even a theory of property rights because relative prices change, or, you know, tomorrow I could value the shoes more than you and then I get them from you. So no property rights would be safe. We'd all die. So much for the GDP. We'd all die because I could just say, well, you know, your car, I value your car more than you. So give your car to me. And if you don't, I'm going to a Coasean judge and he'll give you a car to me. Property rights would no longer be safe. So that's the Coase business. And again, that's one area where I think I made a contribution. Now, let me talk just a little bit about the abortion thing, because Murray is pro-choice and Ron is pro-life. And my view is a thing called evictionism. Now, what the pro-life people say is that the woman who is pregnant has no right to evict, that is, rid herself of the baby, and no right to kill it. And you have to distinguish between evicting and killing, although in the first two trimesters, there's not much of a distinction, because if at our present medical technology, if you evict the fetus in the third month, it dies. So the same result occurs. But if you evict the fetus at the eighth month, the fetus is viable. So the pro-life people say you have no right to evict the fetus, that is before the ninth month when the baby is due, and certainly not to kill it. Whereas the pro-choice people say you have a right to do both. You can evict the fetus whenever you want, and you can also kill it, the partial birth abortion. Now, I'm not sure Murray had that view, but many pro-choice people say that it's a woman's body, a woman's right, yak, yak, yak. She has a right to have to kill that fetus when it's a day before the natural birth would have occurred. My view on this is a compromise. I say you have a right to evict, but not to kill. So where do I get the right to evict? Well, the mother, I resort to property rights, which is half of libertarianism, the other half being the non-aggression principle. And I say, well, you have a right to evict because the unwanted person in your womb, and you're the owner of the womb, you homesteaded that womb long before the baby came along, lady, woman, and you have a right to evict, but not to kill. So take the case of rape. I mean, if that's not a case of trespassing, nothing is a case of trespassing. A woman gets raped, and now there's a baby growing in her body. Certainly she has a right to evict it, but not to kill it, because the baby is innocent. The father is a criminal, but the baby is innocent. And all babies have the same rights. They're all equally innocent. So if you have a right to evict the fetus, you have a right to evict the fetus in the case of rape. You have a right to evict the fetus in any other case. So this is my attempt to bring together the two sides, to bring Ron and Murray together, to say that eviction is the correct libertarian view, and neither pro-life nor pro-choice is the correct libertarian view. So I think those three examples, Coase and open borders and abortion, would be my three areas where I've made some sort of original contribution. And then there's a fourth where I've also done some work where I call this a missile and hiding behind. In other words, what I do, Tom, is I get behind you and under your arm, I start shooting somebody else. Let's say I start shooting Hans Hoppe. And now the question is, well, who has the right to shoot back? You have a gun. We all three have a gun. But for some reason, you can't turn around and shoot me. I'm the bad guy. You can shoot Hans, the victim, or Hans can shoot you. And my claim is a thing called negative homesteading, namely that you were the first person to receive the negative homesteading. I grabbed you. So Hans has a right to shoot you. You don't have a right to shoot Hans. And then the other one is, suppose I pick you up bodily and throw you at Hans, And if there's a contact, both of you will die. And each of you has a gun. And if you one shoots the other one, the other one will stop in his tracks. Well, who has a right to shoot who? Well, again, here, Hans has a right to shoot you. You don't have a right to shoot him, even though you're both equally innocent. But you were the first homesteader of the misery. So I think those are the four areas where I've made some sort of original contribution.
On the abortion question, you and Jakub Wisniewski had a bit of a back and forth, speaking of topics where there's been an exchange.
Yes.
So I'm going to link to that so people can be familiar with the different sides of this. I mean, there's a lot to link that I could link to at tomwoods.com/823. Of course, I'm going to link to walterblock.com so people can look through all your articles. I want to ask you about, though, a question not about any specific topic, but about publishing in general. I know I've got some younger people who listen. Some of them are college students. Some of them even are graduate students. What do you give them, or even young professors for that matter, what do you give them as advice about publishing, just in general, publishing articles in particular?
Three words, never give up. When I get a rejection, and I get rejections, plenty of rejections. Oh, by the way, I don't think I might have more rejections from the American Economic Review than anyone else. I don't like to brag, but I must have maybe 100 rejections from them. I'm not sure. A lot. And they're the most prestigious journal in mainstream economics. The most prestigious journals in Austrian economics are the QJE or RAE or Where Do the Sotos Journal. But those are not seen as worthy of, you know, promotion or tenure on the part of most economists, because most economists are neoclassical. My three-word advice is never give up. So when I get a rejection, what I do is I look at the referees' reports. A lot of times the editor says, well, you know, this is a piece of crap and we're not even sending it to referees. So that doesn't help me. But sometimes they'll say why. And more often, most places, they'll referee the thing and they'll go give it to two or three referees. And each of the referees will say something, why they're rejecting my paper. And I'll read it. And if they say something sensible, rare, but if they say something sensible, I'll redo the paper. And then I'll send it out to another journal. And then I'll send it out to another journal. And then I'll send it out to another journal. My world's record is 36 rejections.
That's did you not ever stop and say, maybe this is just a crummy article?
No. My attitude is pearls before swine. If I write it, it's great. Yeah, my advice to young professors or graduate students who want to get a job in academia, and in order to get a job in academia in this discipline, you have to have referee journal articles, not books. In literature and in history, I think it's books more than referee journal articles, but I'm not sure. But in this one, you have to have referee journal articles. And my advice is never give up. Pearls before swine. I have another article right now that I've co-authored with two people, and we've had maybe 26 or 27 rejections. My two co-authors said, well, you know, shouldn't we give up? And I said, what are you kidding? This is another contribution I think I've made, and this is, why is it that libertarians are a failure? Why isn't Ron Paul president, for God's sakes? Why wasn't Murray head of the Council of Economic Advisors? Or, you know, why isn't Bob Murphy head of the Fed? And then he gets rid of the Fed. Why, you know, why does the Libertarian Party get 1% of the vote or 2 or 3% of the vote? Why is libertarianism, which is exquisitely beautiful and correct and ethical, why do most people reject it? And my answer to that is sociobiology. Very few people are mutants. Most people are hardwired for socialism. And this paper has been rejected by maybe 25 journals already. And my co-authors are saying, you know, maybe we should give up. And I say, not on your life. This is a brilliant paper, if I say so myself. I'm not responsible for all of it. I'm maybe responsible for a third of it. And I'm never going to give up. I'm hoping that I break my personal best record of 36 rejections. And I'm going to keep going. And, you know, every once in a while we revise the paper because there is some referee who says something sensible. But mostly they're just full of beans and we ignore them. And I send it out to another journal. In law reviews, it's different. In law reviews, you see, in economics, you're only allowed to send a journal, an article to one journal at a time. And some journals take a day to reject it, like when the editor says, I'm not sending this crap out to a referee. But sometimes they send it out, more often they send it out to a referee, and it takes 3 to 6 months to get all the referees' reports. So to have 36 rejections might have been 5 years or 8 years. And you might think, well, in 8 years, maybe the time dimension creeps in because what you wrote 8 years ago is not relevant. But most of the stuff I write, I think, is timeless. It's, you know, based on principles, so it wouldn't really matter. The examples might be dated 8 years ago or 15 years ago, but that's a minor point. So my advice to young scholars is don't give up. Keep going. I have to mention something else, and that is co-authorships. I remember, Tom, one time you were in a big, big room. There might have been 300 people. And what you said, I'm probably the only person in this room that hasn't co-authored an article with Walter Block.
That was one of my favorite lines ever.
Yes.
And then I can't even use that anymore because eventually we did co-author an article.
Yes, we co-authored one article.
Yeah.
I like to co-author articles. It's sort of a way of making friends. So I now send this out to Radio Land or Blog Land or wherever this interview is going. And that is to all Austro-Libertarian graduate students and young professors who are having trouble getting their article published because they had it rejected 5 times and now they're giving up, send it to me. If I like it, I'll add to it and I'll co-author it with you. Hey, how do you think I get to 500? A lot of co-authorships in there. So I make this offer to all bona fide libertarians and Austrian economists that if you're thinking of giving up on an article, don't. Instead, send it to me. And if I like it, I don't like everything I'm sent, but I like a lot of things that are good Austrian libertarian stuff that are rejected by mainstream journals. First, what I'll do before adding to it and co-authoring it with you is I'll say, well, which journals have rejected it? And you'll give me the list of 5 or 6. And I'll say, oh, here are another 10. Go send it to them. And if these other 10 plus your original 6 all rejected, then send it to me and maybe I'll co-author it with you. And the odds of getting it published with me as a co-author are much higher because I now have editors who really like what I do. And I won't say we'll publish anything. I mean, if I send them something horrible, they're not going to publish it, but they're very likely to publish it. And this whole thing with editors is sort of a crock because if I'm an editor of a journal and I like your article, Tom, what I'll do is I'll send it out to Referee Goody. Referee Goody likes everything. On the other hand, if I don't like what you wrote, Tom, and you sent to me, I'll send it to Referee Batty. And Referee Batty hates everything. And I'll say, well, Referee Batty didn't like it, so I'm rejecting your paper. So, you know, this whole process isn't really as kosher as it could be. Another point, when you send it out to a law review, you don't have to limit it to one journal. You can send it to 700 law reviews all at one fell swoop with espresso. So if another word of advice to young scholars, if you're writing something that is, say, economics, but it has something to do with law, and most things in economics have to do with law, like the minimum wage law. Suppose you wrote something on the minimum wage law and it got rejected by 25 journals. Well, send it to 700 law reviews and maybe one of them will pick it up. Now, for economics, a law review isn't as good as much credit, but better a publication in a law review, and it doesn't have to be the Harvard Law Review. The XYZ Law Review is better than nothing. So if you're trying to get tenure or trying to get a job and you need more articles published, and another aspect is to send it to a law review, and there you're allowed to send it to 700 or 800 or however many law reviews there are in the world or in the country. You have a much better shot because you have 700 groups looking at it. I have to tell you one other thing, and that is one thing that I'm very proud of in my publications is that I have many, many, almost 100, well, maybe 75 or 80 articles co-authored with students. And these are undergraduate students, and it's very rare for an undergraduate student to get a journal article in a refereed publication. And how did this happen? The way it happened, I remember I was teaching at Holy Cross, and this must have been in 98 or something like that. And what happened is I assigned term papers to all my students, and some of the term papers are pretty good. And in any case, what happened is I got a message from a law review saying, hey, we'd like to publish this paper of yours. And then I wrote back and I said, you know, sorry, I don't have any this article that I sent you. Well, I sent it to another journal. I sent it to dozens of other journals, hundreds of others. And this other journal beat you to it. They accepted it and I accepted their acceptance. Namely, I said I would publish with them. So I can't allow you to publish this because you can't publish it in two places. So the editor wrote back saying, well, we really liked your stuff. Do you have anything else that you could send us? And I didn't, but I had a whole bunch of student term papers. So what I did is I added some stuff to the term paper, and I sent a term paper with maybe a quarter or a third of the material in it that I wrote, and I edited the term paper. And guess what? They accepted it. And I said, whoa, whoop-de-doo. I've got a whole new venue for undergraduate term papers that I assign. And I have maybe 75 or 80, maybe 100 of my undergraduate term papers that have been turned into referee journal articles. Now, of them, I'm the most proud of about five or six that I didn't co-author, but these were term papers where the students criticized me. For example, one of my articles, I said something like the male-female income gap is not due to discrimination. It's due to the fact that women work longer and harder than men, and if they're not and if they're married, then you know they're busy with childcare and stuff. So even if they're of equal ability, they're not going to get as much success academically as men. And I had a girl student, and she wrote a paper just blasting the hell out of me, saying, you know, Block is wrong. Block is an idiot. Now, she was a very good student. She got an A, and I'm very proud that I gave her an A. She earned an A, even though she the whole semester, I mean, she was a total pinko, and all she did was criticize me, but she was a very bright girl. She's now getting a PhD at Duke. She might be finished by now. In any case, she wrote this article saying, you know, Block is full of beans. So I couldn't co-author it because it was an attack on me. So instead, what I did is I added to it, I recommended footnotes, I recommended more bibliography, and I edited the thing because some of the wording wasn't good. And then I got it published in, a very prestigious journal. I forget which one. I could look it up if you want. And then what I did is I wrote to the same journal. I think it was the Journal of Business Ethics. I wrote to the same journal my refutation or my rejoinder, and they rejected it. So this journal accepted a student paper and rejected the professor's paper, namely mine. But I got it published elsewhere. But the point is that I have maybe five or six out of these almost 100 student term papers that are single authored, namely the students, and I help them get it published. And I think this article that this girl wrote was rejected three or four times. And she said, you know, should I give up? I said, never give up. And eventually we got it published. And it was a really decently prestigious journal. I think it was the Journal of Business Ethics, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
All right. Well, one thing I've liked about all this, the great Walter Block story, is that when I would go to what was formerly known as the Austrian Scholars Conference, you would bring a bunch of students from your university with you, and they would have papers to deliver, or they would be attending and they would be interested. It was that you weren't the ordinary professor. You were actually encouraging them to write things up, to get them published. These are not thoughts that occur to students spontaneously. Oh, I think I'll take my term paper and submit it to an academic journal. This never, ever, ever occurs to any undergraduate. And you basically helped give them a leg up in their careers, because who else as an undergraduate has a peer-reviewed journal article? And you did that. Because for you, you're not just punching a clock when you go into school. You really love what you're doing, which is what makes the fact that those SOBs put you through all that nonsense all the more horrifying, because I'm sure they do have people who are simply who just are there to mark the time. And they've got a gem like Walter Block, and they're going to give him a prop. Anyway. I'm getting a little bit off the subject of your articles. WalterBlock.com is where people can get an overview of what you've been doing and can look at a lot of these articles, because a lot of them can be read online. You don't have to go through an academic library to dig them up. You have hyperlinked a bunch of them so they can check them out. Any final words as you reflect on 500 articles? I can't believe that you're saying, well, it's just a number. Get out of town. I would be letting the whole world know that I had done 500 articles. You kidding me?
Well, thanks, Tom. You're very kind. I just wanted to mention one thing. It's a little off the topic, and that is another part of my career that's semi-related to this is that I have now maybe 5 or 6 or 7 former students of mine who are now professors. I think the most famous of them are Andrew Young and Ed Stringham. And there are Dan D'Amico and Nick Snow and 2 or 3 others who are now professors. And they were my undergraduate students. Dan D'Amico is now teaching at Brown University. So that's a very prestigious place. And I also have another 6 or 8 or 10 students who are now in various PhD programs who are also former students of mine. And all of them wrote term papers for me that were published in Referee journals. So this is another way that I've been promoting the careers of my students. And I'm trying to, Murray Rothbard is the most influential person in my life academically. And I'm trying to give back to him. And what he did to me was pass to me the baton, in a relay race, one runner passes a baton to another. Well, Murray Rothbard passed on the baton to me of liberty and libertarianism and Austrian economics. And I'm trying to pass this baton on to my students. And they will then pass on the baton that I gave them, that I got from Murray, that he got from Mises, to their students. So I see myself as part of a long tradition of promoting liberty and good economics, and I'm just delighted that I've made some small contribution, and thanks for having me on your show.
Always a pleasure, Walter. Hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
All right, before I let you go, I want to let you know about another website created by a Tom Woods Show listener. We got so many of them now, and I'm so glad that all you folks are taking the bull by the horns. I had a lot of people starting websites on January 1st, I assume because of New Year's resolutions. Well, that's great. Well, the site I want to tell you about today is kidslearningforlife.com. And this is what the creator of that site wrote to me. My blog is kidslearningforlife.com. I'm currently focusing on giving parents of young children, 1 to 5 years old, and other childcare providers free themed curricula. So many sites in this niche are full of exciting and creative activities, but very few combine those activities in themed curricula. As a daycare provider, I needed curricula, but I couldn't find any curriculum online that fit my daycare needs, so I decided to create my own. Not only do I provide the curriculum for free, I'm doing it in real time with my readers. We just started our colors theme this week, and I'm already getting good feedback through social media. Along with the curriculum, I provide other useful articles to help my readers with their day-to-day activities and routines. So very much worth checking out if you have a child who is 1 to 5 years old. KidsLearningForLife.com is the listener website mentioned for today. It will be linked at TomWoods.com/823. Remember, you too can get a nice shout out like this, plus a link on my site, which will help you in the search engine results because my site has so many links on it. And Google loves it. Plus, membership in my private bloggers group on Facebook. I have 2 private groups, one for the supporting listeners and one for the bloggers. And then finally, you can get 2 dozen free video tutorials to get you up and running as a blogger. All these goodies if you use my link. So check out how you can do that at TomWoods.com/publicity. Tomorrow, if all goes well, I am welcoming back Bob Murphy to the show. And we are going to talk about an article that I just read about Obamacare and how great it's been and how terrible it would be if we got rid of it. And why it's stupid for Trump supporters to favor getting rid of it, because they're the very ones who would be most helped by it. You've probably seen this argument a lot. We're going to take it head on tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.